It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
This is a law that Indiana passed when Mike Pence was the governor. He signed it into law. It had two provisions, and the Supreme Court today upheld one of those provisions. This was a provision of state law that regulated and restricted how fetal remains were to be dealt with after an abortion. They could not be disposed of as medical waste, the state law said. They had to be either cremated or buried, dealt with like any other person. The lower courts invalidated that provision, but today the Supreme Court upheld that part of the law. So that is now upheld by the Supreme Court. The second part of the law restricted the circumstances in which a woman could seek an abortion. It barred abortion providers from doing abortions for basically parents who were expecting to have a Down syndrome child. The law was actually broader than that. It said you can't make abortion decisions based on sex, race, or disability selective abortions. And today the Supreme Court affirmed the lower court decision that invalidated that provision. What the Supreme Court's very brief decision on this says is we're not going to take this case because only the Seventh Circuit has thus far addressed this kind of law. We follow our ordinary practice of denying these cases insofar as they raise legal issues that haven't been considered by other courts of appeals. So in other words, the Supreme Court is saying in this area of the law, we generally don't take cases unless there's a split among the circuits. There really is only one circuit that's dealt with this. So this is a partial victory opponents of abortion rights in Indiana.
All right, Sandy Rios with you. That's a decision that came down just a few days ago by the Supreme Court. It's a half decision. We are all wondering where in the world this court will come down when it comes to issues of the sanctity of human life. But of course, that's not the only thing that we're dealing with the courts. We have judges, federal judges around the country who are single-handedly negating President Trump's proposals, whether it's on the border or other issues. We have a little bit of chaos in our court. We have an interesting lineup. There are 9 of them. The interactions and personal disagreements between them are becoming very intriguing. We have, meanwhile, the Senate rushing through lots of judicial appointments. We know that another Supreme Court seat is most likely to become vacant, certainly within the next year or two. And so the courts have so much to do with how we live our lives. And that's why it's time for an update. And I can't think of anyone better to bring us that update than Carrie Severino. She's chief counsel and policy director for the Judicial Crisis Network. And she joins us this morning. Carrie, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here, Sandy.
Carrie, the other part I meant to tell people, and I want to right away, that you have a new book coming out, which we're going to do an interview on that as soon as it does come out. It's coming out in July, called Justice on Trial, in which you and Molly Hemingway kind of chronicle the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh. First of all, congratulations. And can you just give us a little, just a word, just a tease about that book?
Oh, yeah. This is really going to be the definitive story of what went on during that confirmation. We talked to, everyone from the president, the vice president, several Supreme Court justices, a bunch of senators, 100 people at least, about what happened during that confirmation process. And it's so important both because you'll find things that the news certainly didn't report on that even I didn't know at the time. And it's important because, as you said, there's probably going to be another vacancy coming up. We know eventually there will be. And we need to learn as a country how not to allow smears and personal attacks to be the order of the day when we are confirming nominees to the court.
Well, I can't wait. And certainly I know that you and Molly both were attending to that all the time. Most of us were watching that, but you guys had a front row seat. And we're writing about it and reporting on it. And so, honestly, that will be fascinating. And I can't wait. And I can't wait to talk to you about it. So, but anyway, it's going to be called Justice. It is called Justice on Trial.
Justice
it will be
trial.
Out in July. In July, we'll be talking about it. All right, Carrie, so earlier in the week, the Supreme Court issued this decision on the Indiana abortion law. We heard that bit of a overview, but why don't you restate it? What exactly were they addressing? What did they address and what did they not address?
Yeah, there were two aspects to the laws they were considering. One had to do with the disposition of fetal remains. So often what happens after an abortion is the remains of the fetus are just incinerated with other medical waste, and as they put it, infectious waste. And the state said that it shouldn't be treated automatically with infectious and pathological waste, but that giving the mother the opportunity to determine how she wanted the fetal remains to be disposed of, potentially cremating them in a similar process, but just not automatically with surgical waste. That, the court said, was a valid regulation on Indiana's part. The Seventh Circuit had struck it down, and the Supreme Court said, no, all you have to have is a rational basis and a rational relationship to a state interest. The state has an interest in ensuring the respectful disposal of human remains. And so this is a perfectly rational decision. That was half of the case.
Carrie, let me interrupt you just for a second. I just was recalling as you were telling that, I remember when I was on radio in Chicago, and I, of course, was very involved with the pro-life movement, with Pro-Life Action League and Joe Shidler, people who you may have known in your distant past or when you were a girl. I don't know. But I will never forget the incidences of them finding trash bins filled with baby remains, you know, dumpsters filled with. And so this has been an issue for decades, really. So really, we treat them like we already abort them, and then we just put them in the dumpster and let them be carried off by the trash machine. And so that was a huge issue a long time ago. So it's interesting. Now the Supreme Court has said, at least in Indiana, this is not going to apply to other states, that they cannot be disposed of as trash anymore, right?
Right. Well, that is Indiana's choice as law, but what it says is if other states wanted to pass a similar law, that law does pass this rational basis test, saying there is, you know, the state has a reasonable right to protect the disposal of human remains, and they can do so in the case of abortion as with other human remains.
Okay. Okay, interesting. So other states could just now jump on that and get the job done in their own state. Okay, so the second part that they did not take on, what was that?
Right. That had to do with discrimination in the case of abortion. So it prohibited abortion if the sole reason was for discrimination based on the child's sex, their race, or their disability status. And we know, and then Justice Thomas wrote separately, kind of just to, as he often does, to really flesh out and give an outline. The main court did not take opinion on this one way or the other. Justice Thomas pointed out the instances worldwide, particularly in Asia, of discrimination against women and the fact that many more female babies are aborted than male. Talked about, in Iceland, for example, almost all children with Down syndrome are aborted, and that's certainly an issue that comes up in our country as well. And then how, if you look even in this country, the percentage of Black children who are aborted versus white and Hispanic as well. So basically, I think he was trying to explain Indiana's justification for having a concern that abortion was being used as a tool for eugenics, as he put it. The court did not decide to take that issue up. It simply said, we don't have there's only one federal appeals court that has issued a decision on that case. And typically what they will do is wait for more than one appeals court to weigh in and have a split so that they are basically the tiebreaker, not really a tiebreaker, but a deciding case where there is a disagreement among the courts of appeals. Right now we have the Seventh Circuit alone that has made a determination on this aspect of the law. And so what they're going to want to do is wait for another circuit to weigh in before the Supreme Court would take up a case like that.
Carrie, do you consider that a dodge, or do you think that's a legitimate reason not to take up that second part?
Well, I think it is actually very typical of what the Supreme Court does. There's thousands of cases they are petitioned to take every year. And as a clerk looking at those and trying to decide which ones do you recommend for cert, it was actually very common to say, well, this case is just error correction, basically acknowledging, saying, we think the case was decided wrongly below, but it's only just correcting an error in this one case. There's not a real split to deal with, et cetera. So I think it's actually fairly typical. I know there's a lot of people who may have wanted to see it be taken up. I'll point out, though, that Justice Thomas did say in his concurrence, the court is going to have to address this issue eventually. But there weren't justices filing a dissent from denial of cert. Now, that doesn't mean there weren't some justices who thought they should have taken it, but none of them seem to think this is a time where it's egregious the case court isn't taking it. So I do think it fits within their typical behavior to say, let's wait for a circuit split.
Yeah, let me also add that in the first part that they did take about disposing of remains and treating them like they're human remains, the court voted 7-2. That was actually pretty surprising to me and encouraging. And Justices Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Sonia Sotomayor were the ones that dissented. So that's just interesting to know. But the larger issue on this, Carrie, I think people that really want to know, is that the whole issue with the rash of state legislatures who were passing these really strong pro-life, pro-preservation of little baby life bills, Alabama having the most, we could use the word strident, but strict, we could say. If this court really will find the courage to take up one of these bills and actually overturn Roe versus Wade, I'd love to know what you think about that.
But I don't think anyone knows what's going to happen in terms of what they'll take up and when they would take it up. I think what we've seen is we've got states on both sides really testing the limits of how far you can go in either extreme. You've got Alabama and Georgia on one side, but then you've got states like New York that are saying, we want abortion all 9 months, and then you've got people, the Virginia law that didn't ultimately pass, but are basically saying, up until the very moment of birth, the governor is suggesting that perhaps past the moment of birth. So, you've got a very wide range in terms of what the states are looking at. At the same time, you've got polling that recently came out showing that 3 in 4 Americans actually do suggest that there should be some limits on abortion. That's including a majority of people who say they are pro-choice, who think there should be some limits. So I think the reality is America is very divided in terms of, and there's a lot of people on both extremes, and there's a lot of people in the middle. Again, people who think themselves as pro-choice, but also think there should be some limit. I think it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. And remember, Roe versus Wade just took that issue out of the hands of the state and put it in the federal government. I think if eventually, and I don't know, if or when that would happen, if it were overturned, what you would see is something like what we're seeing play out in these states now. You're going to see a wide range. You're going to see some states that are able to come to a kind of political compromises that are now foreclosed by the Supreme Court thing that are somewhere in the middle. So it's interesting to watch that kind of play out.
Yeah. So just to be clear, the states like Alabama and Georgia, the other states that have passed these restrictive bills, like heartbeat bills, the Ohio bill. I'm assuming, because the left always does this, they challenge in court immediately. Like, the ink is not even dry and there's a challenge. But is there a challenge on the New York law that's so radical? Is there a challenge on that one?
I think it would be hard. I'm not aware of one, but it's different on the other side because there is not a claim there's a constitutional prohibition on abortion. Through Roe versus Wade, we have the one side saying this is constitutional, you cannot do this. I think actually most people on the other side, and this is certainly Justice Scalia's decision, is the Constitution actually doesn't speak to abortion one way or the other. It should. So this is something that would go back to the state. So yeah. His position would be New York is able to do what it thinks is the right thing on abortion law, but then so is Alabama.
Hold that thought. Carrie Severino is my guest, the Chief Counsel and Policy Director for the Judicial Crisis Network. We're just getting started, so stay tuned. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Call it the power of one. Among nearly 700 federal district or trial judges, just a single jurist can indefinitely block a congressional law or executive action affecting the entire country.
One judge can, in effect, cancel the policy with a stroke of the pen.
They're called nationwide injunctions, and the Trump administration says they've occurred more during this presidency than all others combined.
Since President Trump took office, federal courts have issued 37 nationwide injunctions against the executive branch.
In President Trump's first year alone, judges issued 20 nationwide injunctions, as many as President Obama's 8 years in office. They include a range of hot-button issues, especially immigration, rescinding grant money to sanctuary cities, rolling back the so-called Dreamers program for people brought to the U.S. illegally as children, and the travel ban, including a number of majority Muslim countries, a policy ultimately upheld by the Supreme Court last year. Also, restrictions on transgender individuals joining the military and several abortion-related directives. Injunctions have the effect of binding the government from implementing laws or policies at least until the issue is fully litigated. Some legal advocates say the shift is necessary. When the alleged harm is nationwide, the legal relief must be as well.
The suggestion that it's only very liberal judges who are putting a hold on President Trump's policies is simply not true. This is a matter of justice. It's not a matter of politics when it comes to the judicial branch.
The Trump administration is pushing back, looking for the right case to present to the Supreme Court. But the issue likely would not be resolved in a presidential election year.
So the administration thinks it ultimately does have a winning hand, since the president's two justices now create a solid conservative majority. Justice Clarence Thomas, in particular, is eager to address it. Last June, he called these nationwide injunctions, quote, legally and historically dubious, and all but invited a legal challenge to come to the high court.
All right, Shannon Bream on Fox, last week, actually. And then just at the beginning of, at the end of the last week, Judge Haywood Gilliam of the Northern District of California issued an injunction stopping the transfer of funds from the military to fund and to build part of the border wall on with Mexico. And now we know that Judge Gilliam was an Obama appointee and actually gave $30,000 to Obama's reelection campaign and other Democratic candidates. So, Houston, we have a problem. So, Carrie Severino is the Chief Counsel and Policy Director for the Judicial Crisis Network. This nationwide injunction, I think, Carrie, I'm really curious to know, has this been used in the past? I mean, has this just become the common practice during the Trump administration, or has this kind of cropped up before in past decades?
Well, as Justice Thomas pointed out, it's something that historically is dubious, but this isn't the very first time we've seen him. It has happened, for example, during the administration of President Barack Obama under a couple occasions as well. However, this is something that really has dramatically increased over the last few years, and particularly during the Trump administration. And it's become a clear part of this of a legal strategy where you find a judge that you know is going to be sympathetic, and then instead of just having that judge issue a holding that says, you know, as to the parties in this case, they can't carry out this executive order, for example, or as to the parties even in this district, like, you know, the District of Hawaii, for example, or the Northern District of California, we're going to say they can't do this for the entire country. And that it has some tension, as again, Justice Thomas has pointed out, with the idea that in our system, the judges are authorized by the Constitution to look at cases and controversies. And that means you look at the case before you. You don't decide an issue that is much broader than the case that is presented before you. And so you may be able to decide it as to the litigants in front of you, but not as to, you know, millions of other potential litigants in the country.
One thing I've never quite understood, I've heard discussions, like surface discussions about this, Carrie, but I'm not clear. Does the court, the judicial branch, have the ability to police itself? Are they able to bring rogue judges? Like we just heard, there was one in Utah who's being receiving some sort of censure for his political comments about President Trump. He said some really outlandish things, and yet he's sitting on the bench. In the past, I know the judges have not been able to take political stands on issues. It's been, I don't know if it's written or if it's just custom. So what is the remedy for out-of-control judges like the one in California we just talked about?
Well, it's not merely custom. I mean, there are codes of judicial ethics, and there are real concerns when you have a judge that is, even aside from judicial ethics, simply coming to decisions that are legally not well-founded. So if you have a legally incorrect decision, the typical way that the judiciary polices itself effectively is to simply have appellate courts and ultimately the Supreme Court that will then correct those decisions. Sometimes you do have cases where there's a judge who regularly is coming up with decisions that are very dubious, and you can imagine a case where there may be censure, but there's no authority of a court to, say, remove a judge, however inappropriately he or she is behaving. The only constitutional way to do that, because judges have life tenure, they serve during good behavior, it says, is through impeachment. That's obviously something that's very rarely been employed, but has on numerous occasions been so. So, I think that is the ultimate question, is whether there's, actual political will to impeach someone. Generally, the courts are able to kind of keep the other judges in line simply by making sure that they realize you're being looked upon as someone who's simply very political or not a very good judge if you're overturned so regularly. However, there's certainly a lot of judges who seem to be fairly immune to that type of criticism from their colleagues. So, it's a limited ability to push back on judges.
Well, so how the executive branch under President Trump is talking about doing something, and is that reduced to just simply finding a case that would bring a challenge that would take it all the way to the Supreme Court?
Well, in terms of doing something about the idea of having these nationwide, or they're also called universal injunctions, that's something that they could push back on simply by, if they had finally a legal determination, ideally by the Supreme Court, that this is actually not an appropriate, you cannot issue injunctions beyond the scope of the case in front of you, beyond your own district in which you sit, for example. That is, if they had that determination, then you would have the lower courts simply not able to issue those kind of broad injunctions. And if they tried to do so, they would immediately get reversed by the courts. So I think that's presumably the direction they would like to go. Justice Thomas has already said he would be very open to seeing that kind of a challenge. We have yet to see what the remaining justices would do with it.
But Carrie, the other part of this, of course, is separation of powers. The executive branch has equal power with the judicial. I know you know that. I just thought I'd tell you that.
Okay.
So the president, it seems to me, could just defy. I mean, could not the other branches defy what they view as an unconstitutional order?
They could. That is something that would be a real constitutional challenge, though. I mean, I think there's a lot of debate over exactly at what point a president can say, he has made his decision. Let's see him enforce it. So historically, it happened, but very rarely. And I think the much more solid legal ground would be to say, let's get the Supreme Court to agree with me on the legal basis here. So otherwise, you would have a real constitutional challenge. But it's not an issue that hasn't come up before. President Lincoln had it. A real concern where he was defying the Supreme Court's determinations himself. So it's not unprecedented, but I think the best thing is to get something where everyone can agree. This is the legal result. The Supreme Court has agreed with us, and let's now move forward and get these rogue judges in line.
Okay, so Carrie, this is the season. 'Tis the season when we find out actually these cases have been heard by the Supreme Court justices. They've been working on these for months. But we don't, in many cases, know what the decision is, and we don't know till like June, isn't it, when they start releasing these decisions?
Yeah, it's the end of June. So we're now at a state where every Monday, and now this week we had one on Tuesday because it was the Memorial Day on Monday. But we'll have every Monday some decisions coming out by the Supreme Court, and of course, disproportionately, the most interesting and significant ones often tend to be. Coming out at the very end, because there are more back and forth opinions going around amongst the judges trying to hammer those out.
And they would be, you think this session, they would be what?
Some of the big cases?
Yes.
Well, we have some, I think some of the most interesting ones to me involved some really core questions of the separation of powers and how the federal system works. So we're looking at questions of must the courts defer to an agency, for example? So much gets done by these federal agencies, and can they basically define their own terms of the laws and the regulations they do, and the courts have to agree with their interpretation, or can the courts really function properly as courts in those cases? You have questions about the relationship between states and the federal government, whether there's double jeopardy and separate sovereigns, like whether they get treated separately in the federal and state governments. And that's actually a really big back and forth between states and the federal government. We already had one important case that was a Thomas decision that said that the states actually do have a lot more authority than we had thought before. So, and then we also have a question of the non-delegation doctrine. Now, these all get into these picky sounding things, but again, it goes back to the same question of can the agencies and not entities other than Congress effectively write the laws? And that's a real problem. In this case, it has to do with the Congress basically giving the Attorney General authority to determine how they do the sex offender registry. But it's been used in so many other ways where Congress doesn't want to make the tough decisions. They hand that on to agencies that are headed often by someone who was never elected. In the case of this case that's come up, at least it's the Attorney General who was confirmed by the Senate. Many of these other situations, you're having regulators deciding these issues who were never elected, were never even confirmed by the Senate. Ultimately, it's a real concern to have them giving away that authority that constitutionally belongs to Congress. And so I think these are very important cases for pushing back on the wild overgrowth of the administrative state that we have seen in past decades. So that's going to be interesting to see. I think this is a long-running battle, I guess, between these administrative agencies and the proper constitutional structure.
Carrie, let me make that real plain for people listening, because those terms that you use, and I know because we're D.C. people, we know what that means. But what this really means is we elect our congressmen to make laws that govern us, and we place our trust in them. But what's happened, and you said this, but I'm just saying it a different way, is all of these huge agencies, huge, and I don't know if it got worse under, I would say, from my perspective, under Barack Obama, they became out of control, and they ended up exercising control over the American people by initiating these rules that they were not laws, and they were criminalized, and people went to jail over breaking these rules. And I'll get one comes to mind, this Joseph Robertson, who was a Montana rancher. He dug two ponds fed by a trickle that ran down his mountain acres. Then he was prosecuted and imprisoned for what they call polluting the navigable waterways. That was a rule that the Environmental Protection Agency had written. So that's, and you and I both know there were people who were fined like thousands of dollars a day. We had incredible infringements on our personal liberties from these rules written by agencies, and that's what you're talking about.
Exactly, and under the current deference that courts give to agencies, the statute may say navigable waterways, but if the agency wants to say this, stream that you could maybe float a paper boat on, but certainly no real, any kind of craft that you would imagine it counts as a navigable waterway, they can say, this is a navigable waterway. And the Supreme Court is more or less tying its own hands in many cases and saying, okay, well, we have to go with your definition. That's not how our system should work. Courts don't get to be pushed around by what these unelected agencies are telling them. They're not even Congress, let alone the judge that is supposed to be interpreting our laws. So it's a real problem when we cede that kind of authority to an out of control agency like that.
And that kind of brings me to kind of the personality issue, which I wanted to get into. Hopefully we can in a minute. But Judge Thomas, you've mentioned him, Justice Thomas, you've mentioned him already a couple times is really at odds. Let's just pick these two personalities with Justice Stephen Breyer. And it is over this whole business of, well, part of it is the, I don't know if this is related. I think it's related in some way, the precedent of the court. In other words, Justice Thomas believes that the Constitution is the final authority. And whatever that says, that's what we should go with. While people like Justice Breyer think that there can be added things like the rules and regulations of these agencies and like the precedent of the court. And you hear the music, Carrie. Carrie, can you hang on just a few more minutes?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Sorry. We're going to take another break. And when we come back, we'll take this up again and let Carrie kind of make some sense out of what I just said, if she can. And also, I do want to talk about the other cases. There are so many interesting cases, mm-hmm. plus the personalities on the court. It's really interesting. So stay tuned. Carrie Severino, Chief Counsel and Policy Director of the Judicial Crisis Network and author of the upcoming book called Justice on Trial, about Kavanaugh's trial. It's Kavanaugh's hearing. Should be fascinating. Stay tuned. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
We have some breaking news that's just in. The U.S. Supreme Court has just blocked lower court rulings that invalidated new maps, including Ohio's map for congressional districts and Michigan's maps for congressional and state legislative districts. So before I go to the story I was telling you about, I want to go to Pete Williams with the latest on this. Pete, what have you got?
So these were requests from the Republican legislatures in both of those states. The lower courts had declared the new maps that were drawn after the last census to be partisan gerrymanders. What that means is the lower courts had found that the legislatures had used partisanship in an excessive manner to disadvantage the minority parties, in this case, the Democrats. Now, the Supreme Court has two cases pending this term that raises the question of whether the exercise of gerrymandering, that is to say, drawing the electoral maps for congressional districts in Ohio, in this case, Michigan congressional and legislative districts, raising the question about whether drawing those maps, which is an inherently political exercise, can become so political that it's unconstitutional, and if so, where that line is to be drawn. Neither of those two decisions has come out yet, so it's unclear whether the Supreme Court is putting those cases on hold until it decides the cases that are pending or exactly what's going on here. But in any event, the effect of those lower court rulings affecting Ohio and Michigan is now on hold until the Supreme Court decides whether to take and how to dispose of those controversies, Allie.
This is just an example. Sandy Rios back with you of a case that the Supreme Court is hearing or not going to hear that has tremendous impact. And that is this whole issue of gerrymandering. Both parties do it. They draw the district boundaries to favor their own party. The state legislatures do this. The one in Maryland, there's been a challenge to Maryland for gerrymandering their districts to advantage Democrats. And so the Supreme Court's trying to decide whether they should get involved in an issue which is really a state's issue, and it will have impact on the upcoming elections, because I think the lower courts had ruled that these states, at least Ohio and Michigan, had to redraw those boundaries. And I think there was North Carolina also, maybe Texas, before the 2020 election. So it would have an impact on the outcome of the elections, no doubt about it. Carrie Severino, my guest this morning, Chief Counsel and Policy Director for Judicial Crisis Network. Tell us about what's your perspective on this, Carrie, and where it stands.
Right. Well, this is an issue that the Supreme Court has dealt with time and time again and has not been able to come up with a really good, clear answer to. It seems like they aren't super comfortable with the idea that states are being redistricted because of partisan lines. But historically, the only thing the Supreme Court has said is you can't district based on racial lines. But partisan lines, they just have said, you know what, we can't get involved in that. There is no standard we can say by what is too partisan, what is not partisan enough. And that's where the court has kind of left it. It seemed like Justice Kennedy might have been still wanting to fish around and maybe we can find some standard. He is obviously no longer on the court, and Justice Kavanaugh has replaced him. So I think it'll be interesting to see if the court is finally able to come to a conclusion now that we have Kavanaugh replacing Kennedy, who was for such a long time kind of he couldn't get comfortable with the idea that there wasn't a clear standard in the law to prohibit gerrymandering. I think what it ends up being, and there are many cases that fall into this category, that the court simply says this has to be dealt with by partisan politics. There isn't a legal standard we can apply that here. And then it goes to the states to kind of duke it out. And as you said, there's going to be Democrats who try to draw the lines to favor themselves, and there's Republicans who will draw the lines to favor themselves. But over time, the political process just tends to hash that out.
Do you think that that's going to be the end of it for the court this session then?
Well, again, it depends on how they decide the case. What they have done repeatedly over the last decades really is said, well, maybe there's a standard, but we can't find it in this case. And they have never come up with a good rule. If they can come up with a good rule, even if that rule is simply we can't determine when political gerrymandering is a problem, and so we're not going to hear more of those cases and we have to let it get worked out in the political process, then I think it would be an end to the process. If they continue in their pattern, which they've had for a long time, of trying to hint at standards but that aren't really clear ones, unfortunately what we keep on seeing is it then comes back to the court, because if you have a vague standard, there's always going to be someone that finds, you know, another way to read it, and it doesn't determine what happens in the next case. And that becomes a real frustration for all of the states, you know, as we see in these two, and we see this almost every time, where they draw some maps, and then there's this heated battle all the way up to the election sometimes, trying to determine what these lines are going to be. I think in some ways, it just would be better to have closure on it rather than having to have this battle every single time.
All right. The other big decision that, I mean, I'm certainly waiting. I'm not sure we have any way of knowing how they're going to come down on this, but this has repercussions, political repercussions, and that is the census citizenship question, including a question about citizenship on the 2020 census, which has to be decided right away because they have to get those forms out to get the census started. And the way it affects the political process is, of course, that this will determine the size of various districts, and then that will decide the number of representatives from different states. And the reason California, for instance, has so many congressmen is because they count. They include people that aren't citizens. And so that's a huge issue. So what's your feeling about this, Carrie? Do you think any feeling about which way this might come down?
It's very difficult because it was hard to determine from the oral arguments in that case where the justices are going to go in this case. So, you could kind of predict maybe a few of them, but I don't think anyone can tell at this point. So it's very frustrating, and it's hard for those who are kind of waiting in limbo to figure out how are we doing this census to know what to go. I think this is unfortunately one of the really important cases that may be held until June 24th, the last day of the term.
Yeah, you're probably right. Let's go back to personalities, because we started talking a few minutes ago about the sort of the tension, at least judicial decision tension, between Justice Thomas and Justice Breyer on this issue of, really it's a difference in philosophy. The New York Times did a great article about this. You probably saw it. Very different philosophy, that of Justice Thomas, who believes that the Constitution is the final arbiter, and it should be the thing that we look to, and where Justice Breyer, like other members, liberal members on the court, believe that we have a living Constitution and that the courts sort of supply that modernizing factor where they decide cases maybe not congruent with the Constitution, but that is just as valid, and that creates precedent upon which the court decides. So it's really, I don't know, this is a collision course, don't you think?
Yeah, and it's interesting because Justice Breyer himself has very kind of opposing views. His view is the Constitution can evolve, which is opposed to Justice Thomas's view of the Constitution is what it is, and we have to figure out how to determine what that is. But Breyer of late, and you alluded to this before the break too, has been talking about the importance of the court sticking by precedent and sticking by stare decisis. So what's ironic to me is it seems like Breyer is saying the Constitution itself can evolve, but precedent is forever.
You're going, that's true. That's true, isn't it?
Has to be the lodestar, the thing we stick by. For goodness sake, it should be the Constitution. So I think really what you're seeing here is when justices are looking at a decision that they're worried they don't have five votes to stick with and they like that decision, suddenly you hear them talking a lot about precedent. And I think that's so you're going to see the liberal justices now with Justice Kavanaugh on the court. You're going to see them talking about stare decisis a lot because I think they're very worried that some of these liberal precedents that aren't maybe as constitutionally well established are going to be vulnerable. However, I think it's really important to remember stare decisis. No justice in the court thinks that every piece of precedent needs to stay and always should stay. And that includes Justice Breyer. Today, he is very excited about stare decisis. He thinks it's an outrage when the court disagrees with him to overturn a case. However, he himself also does call for the court to overturn cases. Most recently, I think it was significant in the death penalty situation where he thinks that the court should morph its constitutional decisions and should overturn some of its previous cases as well as kind of evolve the constitutional language on that topic. So all of the justices agree that certain cases should be overturned. I think the real question is, how do you decide which cases are correct and which cases are incorrect? And then we go back to the judicial philosophy. Are you looking at the text of the Constitution? Are you looking at how it was understood by those who ratified it? Or are you looking at kind of current polling data and where I think the Constitution should go or where I think the American people want it to go? Those are very different ways to interpret the document. But no one thinks, no one believes in stare decisis for everything. I think some people will just sort of behave that as if it's sacrosanct when they're upset that it's getting overturned.
Okay, so another interesting dynamic is you've got, my understanding is that Judge Kavanaugh and Justice Kavanaugh and Justice Gorsuch came up the same way. They clerked for Kennedy. They both went to the same undergrad school. I think they were in all the same circles, and they're close to the same age. And so the expectation was that when Kavanaugh got in, that he would rule, you know, that he and Gorsuch would be identical in terms of their outlook on these cases. But that hasn't been the case, has it, Carrie?
You know, it's not the case across the conservatives on the court generally. I think it's really interesting to see, and you know, some of the liberal journalists have noted this as well, that the liberal justices in the court tend to really vote similarly and very consistently, whereas the conservatives have a wider variety of results. And I think it's because they are trying to do something that is much harder in many ways. This is not looking at just what is the result I like in this case. It is, how do I interpret these laws? How do I look at the text in a responsible way? How do I look at the Constitution and what it meant? And I think they're using these same techniques, but that doesn't always control the specific result. So you'll have cases this term where Justice Kavanaugh agreed with the liberals in the court, where Justice Gorsuch did, where Justice Thomas did, because of the way they're interpreting these provisions. And so there is a wide variety. However, if you look at the method that they're using it, all of those justices are at the end of the day saying, I do feel bound by the text of the law. I feel bound by the text of the Constitution. So you're not going to see the decisions that really go out of left field that say, well, as long as this is, you know, enacting what the law intended or what the goals of Congress were without tying it to the actual text and words of the law. And that's what's most important and significant.
I guess the big exception to that would be John Roberts on Obamacare, though. I mean, really, that's exactly what he did. He didn't take the text of the legislation. He made up, he sort of provided a way for it to be held constitutional. And so that brings up a question about him, Carrie. A lot of people say that he is the new Anthony Kennedy. That's how they see him. He's the swing vote. Do you see it that way?
Well, I sort of hope he doesn't see himself that way, because I think this is what we're seeing a constant refrain within the media is people trying to, and this is the same techniques they used right before the Obamacare case, trying to say, if you don't vote against your conservative colleagues, then people will see you as a political actor and that they'll say, oh, he's just voting this way because of conservative reasons. I think that the concern that I would have is if you are voting for any reason other than what you think the proper legal result is in a case, what the Constitution and what the text of the law requires, then you are being a political actor. Whether that means you're acting for or against your colleagues that were appointed by the same party, whether that means you're acting for or against your own political instincts, you can't be, we cannot be driven by what the press is saying, what the legal academia is saying, et cetera. The most recent reporting does suggest that that's what happened during the Obamacare case. I don't think anyone can know what's in Roberts' heart at the time, but it's a concern that the reporting suggests that he came to a conclusion that differs with what his legal initial legal conclusion was in that case. So I would hope that he and his colleagues would bear in mind that that's a path that leads to real concerns about the court's legitimacy, because their legitimacy really, at the end of the day, derives from the fact that they are constitutionally appointed to interpret the laws, to interpret the Constitution itself, and not to try to, you know, cover their own their own reputation with the press or something.
Yeah, absolutely. Well said. We're going to send a copy of your statement to Justice Roberts so he can hear that, Carrie. Carrie, listen, you do such a great service to all of us in the capacity that you serve as Chief Counsel and Policy Director for Judicial Crisis Network. Carrie Severino, author of this upcoming book, Justice on Trial. Sandy Rios in the Morning on AFR Talk.